That's one of my pet peeves when governments put out these targets or crown corporations put out these targets with no details. Because what happens is you media folks come to the economist to explain the numbers, and I can't explain it. I don't know what the heck's going on. You know, I look like somebody who hasn't done their homework.
Really, you weren't even given the assignment properly.
I wasn't even given the assignment. This will be contentious. Again, largely only affects 0.13% of the population, but they're the ones who own all the newspapers and tend to have the ear of government. So I think this issue is going to have an outsized impact on our discourse.
Hi, and welcome to The Missing Middle. I'm Kara Stern.
And I'm Mike Moffitt.
And today we're going to talk about the federal budget.
But before we get started, don't forget to like, subscribe, and leave a comment. We'd love to hear from you.
So the feds have slowly been releasing their housing plans over the last few weeks, sharing a lot of their highlights ahead of time. What's new on housing in the actual budget now?
Yeah, so most of what we got in the budget was details on previous announcements. So they talked about opening up federal land for development. We got some additional details of what they have in mind, particularly opening up Canada Post-owned land and some land owned by National Defense. There were some really wonky things in the budget that, you know, only the biggest housing nerds really care about, but could actually be quite transformative. One is how multinational apartment developers can deduct interest for tax reasons, which I think is the most like in the weeds possible issue, but it actually matters an awful lot for building apartment buildings. So there are basically a bunch of developers who operate in both Canada and the United States who were about to see their taxes go up when building an apartment buildings. There's a bunch of these guys, particularly out in BC, who operate in both Vancouver and Seattle. What the government did here was basically reverse those changes. So I think, you know, that helps. It's a really, in the weeds kind of policy change. But that's where we are with the housing crisis, that, you know, a lot of the big transformative stuff has been done. And now it's just fixing all of these myriad of problems that we have.
From looking at what the federal government can do on housing, and you look at what they've announced in the budget, how would you grade their plans here?
I'd give it an A, maybe an A minus. It's a great plan, but I'm not giving it an A plus. And there's a few reasons why. That I think first, they haven't done a lot on the intersection of housing and climate. You know, there were a few things in here about insuring against flood risk, some stuff on low carbon. Most of what they're trying to do on housing and climate is legalizing density, which is a great thing. People don't have to drive everywhere. You know, that's going to get emissions down. The other thing that is preventing me from giving them an A+ is they made a commitment in the budget to build an extra 2 million homes. Well, they say the federal government's going to somehow build 1.2 million. The provinces are somehow going to build an extra 800,000. And they give no indication whatsoever about how they're going to get there. The math, basically. I think the goal, as I understand it, is probably a pretty good one. They've made this commitment. I don't quite understand the math behind it. So, you know, that's kind of nitpicky, but it prevents it from being an A+ and simply just an A.
It's not that nitpicky, because really they can promise there'll be 8 gajillion homes, but if they don't actually like give us the details on how they're going to get there exactly, then like it's kind of an empty promise.
Absolutely. So they haven't given us they kind of hand wave like we're going to do this by 2030. I'm like, okay, but what's the start date? What's the end date? Is it, you know, the beginning of 2030, the end of 2030? Like, well, what are the specific cutoffs? And then really wonky stuff, like, what do you count as a home? Which sounds like a really silly question until you recognize that the province of Ontario is counting long-term care beds and college dorms and beds and things like that as home. So we need a lot more details here, and it's one of my pet peeves when governments put out these targets or crown corporations put out these targets with no details. Because what happens is you media folks come to The Economist to explain the numbers, and I can't explain it. I don't know what the heck's going on. You know, I look like somebody who hasn't done their homework.
Really, you weren't even given the assignment properly.
I wasn't even given the assignment. Yeah, exactly. I wasn't even given the assignment. I can't answer these questions, but you know, the media folks are going to keep asking me about it.
Even if we legalize all the different kinds of homes that they're talking about, they make it easier to build, go really big on allowing supply. Do we have the number of laborers and I guess the pipeline to get those laborers? Do we have enough of that in Canada that things actually could be built this quickly?
That is going to be a challenge. If you go to Reddit, you'll see plumbers in Ontario basically saying like, hey, I don't have the work to do right now. You know, I'm between jobs because housing starts are down. So at least at the moment, we actually have a surplus in some of the trades when it comes to home building. Like we actually have tradespeople sitting around doing nothing because of the slowdown. But absolutely, at some point, you know, some housing level, you do start to run into a trade shortage. And I think we need to approach this two ways. The first is getting more skilled tradespeople. And there are some aspects of the budget that does that. The Canadian Building Trades Union came out very favorable of the budget yesterday. But the other thing we need to do is just build homes with fewer people. We haven't had much in the way of a productivity increase in the housing sector in the last 50 years. We build homes the same way we did, you know, when my dad was doing it back in the 60s and 70s, but we don't build TVs or cars or anything else the same way. So the government's really put a focus here on productivity and innovation as well. Because I think ultimately that's, you know, we shouldn't be doubling the number of tradespeople to double the number of homes. We should be finding ways to build those homes more efficiently.
And it'd be things like building them in factories and then bringing them there, having prefabricated rooms. That's how it would work, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. That's a lot of it, because robots can work 24/7 and you can have machine operators who are not tradespeople. And it's not necessarily kind of an all or nothing that, you know, you either build all the home in a factory or none of the home. You know, it could be things like building the roofing truss or part of the roofing truss in the factory and then shipping it on site. So there are, you know, panelization, there are these other kind of methods, mass timber being another one. The mass timber folks hate this analogy, but basically like building a six-story mass timber building is kind of like putting together IKEA furniture. You know, you have the different blocks and a giant Allen key. Well, that part's not true, but it's a lot of, you know, snapping things together, things like that. It's just a different form of building. So absolutely.
Picturing like an industrial Allen key where they just like need a bunch of people to help make it work.
I'm picturing like three burly dudes just hanging on to something like, oh, overall though, I think we do need to figure out how to mechanize this. And the more we can do it in factories and, run things 24/7 rather than relying on 40-hour work weeks, I think we'll be better off.
A lot of the media is focusing on the change to the capital gains tax. Can you walk us through this change and whether it actually is as significant as some people think it is?
Yeah, absolutely. So this one is a little bit complicated, but this is kind of the perfect show for it. So basically, if you have a capital gain, at least one that's not in a tax shelter, so it's not in your RRSP, your TFSA, your single residence home, you have to pay income tax on that capital gain after you sell. So let's say you buy $1 million worth of stock, it goes up to $2 million. You have to pay income tax on that. Now, right now, you only have to pay tax on half of that increase. Half of it's tax free, half of it you pay tax on. And the theory there is that you know, let's say if it's stock, the company's already paid corporate income tax, right? So you want to make sure that you're not, you know, massively taxing the same thing twice. You want to even things out. Or as they say in tax law, a buck should be a buck should be a buck, that regardless of how the income made, the tax level should be kept the same. And that 50% ratio has changed. It actually declined over time. It used to be 100%. Well, actually, before 1972, it was 0%. Then over time, it went up to 100, got ratcheted down to 75%, to 50%, and so on. And there was a feeling that basically it was incentivizing certain types of behavior, and was basically just exempting kind of rich people out of paying their fair share of taxes. So what the federal government did here was say, okay, we're going to increase that ratio from 50% to 2/3. So basically 1/3 of your capital gains are still exempt from tax, but you got to pay income tax on the other 2/3. But interestingly, they only made that for capital gains over $250,000. So you have to be having a lot of $250,000 a year. So you got to have a lot of capital gains in a single year for this to even hit you. According to the budget, that this will apply to 0.13% of taxpayers in any given year. So basically one person out of every 700 or so will be hit by this. The other 699 won't experience any changes.
So it's kind of a way to tax the wealthy to be able to pay for a lot of the spending they have, right? Like, it's really about taxing wealthy here.
Yeah, absolutely. They estimate it will bring in about $4 billion a year, which again is actually quite a bit of money when you consider, again, it only applies to one person out of 700. But, you know, we'll have some interesting cases, particularly when it comes to housing. The obvious thing that I think people recognized immediately is folks that own a cottage and end up selling it are probably going to get dinged by this, particularly if you bought a place back in Muskoka, let's say in 1987, and went to sell it now, you're going to see a profit of more than $250,000. That's for sure. So this is going to affect some people. You know, how much we should cry for Muskoka cottage owners, I'll leave to the audience. But yeah, this will affect some people. Some people will get caught up on this. And on the housing side, it's interesting because, like, let's say you're doing this on stock. You can time the sales of that stock so you're not having massive capital gains 1 year and then nothing the other. You can go, okay, I'm going to sell a bit of my stock every single year so I'm not affected. I'm not affected by the higher rate. It's harder to do that on a home, on a secondary property, right? Because it's, you know, you don't usually sell a third of a house over 3 years. So, you know, it's going to be interesting to see what this does to investors / speculators of secondary properties.
So that might mean that they actually just hold on to the property instead of selling it, right?
Yeah, it's possible. It's possible that they may just hold on to it, continue to rent it. This could, you know, at least in theory, slow down investors buying new properties, which actually could slow down construction. So I'm hopeful that over the next couple of months, because this doesn't go into effect until June 25th, that there's some consultations with industry, with people in the housing sector, to make sure that there aren't any large unintended consequences, and, you know, add tweaks here or there, add necessary exemptions, so we're not, you know, this doesn't slow down housing construction. So this will be contentious. Again, largely only affects 0.13% of the population, but they're the ones who own all the newspapers and tend to have the ear of government. So I think this issue is going to have an outsized impact on our discourse, even if it's not necessarily having an outsized discourse on our economy. And as well, like, I do think there are politics here. I think this might be a fight that the liberals are happy to have. Go, okay, you know what? if people want to say that we're being too mean to the rich in our policy, I don't think that's the kind of thing that the liberals would be upset to fight about. I think they'd rather have that fight than, you know, fights about carbon pricing, which have dominated the news over the last couple of years.
Yeah, and it kind of plays nicely into their theme of trying to attack what they call like generational unfairness, looking at wealth inequality like that. It kind of feels like it's if they take on that fight, that they're on the right side in terms of what they're trying to get across to people who have been priced out, right?
Yeah, no, I absolutely. So I think this really is a generational equity play. And the government's really signaled that. Like they had an entire chapter in the budget devoted to millennials and Gen Z. You know, politically, I don't know if that will work. I don't know how many people over 40 are reading the budget, let alone under 40. But yeah, there really is. They really are trying to send this signal.
Well, I'm glad we have you here to help us understand what's in the budget, because like you said, most people don't have the time to go through a 400 odd page budget that sets out so much dense information, really in the weeds. So this is why you're awesome, Mike Moffitt. Thank you to everyone for watching and listening. And thanks, as always, to our producer, Meredith Martin.
And if you have any burning economic or housing questions, please feel free to reach out to us at missingmiddlepodcast@gmail.com.
And we'll see you next time.